There are a few people out there who have bigger ideas and insights than most of us, and I must say Kate is one of them. We're going to be talking through a bit of her career, but most interestingly, how she sees the challenges in what we're building of cities and urbanisation today and for the 20 years ahead. Hi, welcome to the podcast. Today we have on Dr. Kate, or Kate Azutoa, who's from a director at Urbis in Brisbane. Kate, would you like to introduce yourself and a little bit about what you do and your fantastic history to where you are and what you do today?
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast. I actually found the process of preparing for today quite illuminating. It made me go back over what's now quite a long career. It was a bit like writing my own obituary, I guess. So from the beginning, I grew up in a really interesting household at quite a remarkable time, sort of between the end of the Second World War and the turn of the millennium. And what made it interesting was my dad was one of a new breed of strategic regional planners. And so I grew up in a household with many of the names that now we look back on as urban professionals. And, you know, we think, wow, these people really challenged our thinking and they changed the future direction of our profession. They used to come and drink tea in my house. They were just people I grew up with. And in the time that I was thinking about what I wanted to do with my life, I really wanted to be a journalist, and my parents wouldn't let me because my parents felt that journalism was probably a very insecure profession and I should do something I could always make money from. So they sent me off to the London School of Economics to do law. And it turned out I was not very good at law, but I loved London. And at the time, the mid-80s, London was like this urban laboratory of ideology, and questions that were flying all over the place were about, do we design cities for cars or for people? Do we hollow out the centre and create new towns, or do we invite everybody to come back? What is the impact of industrial restructuring? How do we cope with this industrial land in the centre of our cities? What does this mean? And it just fascinated me. The process of change fascinated me. And my whole life, whatever I've been doing in a career sense, it's always come back to the process of change and how you imagine a better future and how you work out how to get yourself there. And I think that all the studying I've committed to, all the job changes that I've ever done, the transplantation of a family from the UK to Australia was all about being part of processes of change. And that's really been the common thread throughout a now fairly lengthy career.
Well, and absolutely. And we obviously had a fantastic pre-chat as well. And I mean, we are in one of those times where we are seeing change faster than we've ever seen any other time. And, you know, I think it's one of those things that you mentioned before, you know, your parents or your father may have been having to consider what is the next 20 years. But for us, I don't know if we can see past the next five.
Absolutely. I think that is one of the greatest challenges that we're facing as a profession, but also as a community, that we're being asked to make decisions for a future we just can't imagine. And that it's not just one change. So we're not just thinking about population growth. We're thinking about climate change and technology and economic restructuring and people living in completely different ways. And our communities are multicultural, less monocultural than they've ever been. And so decision making to create better public outcomes feels difficult. And we're asked, practitioners and politicians and policymakers, to make no regrets decisions for long-term futures that are actually really important, not just to our economic competitiveness, but also to our quality of life. In fact, whether we can even sustain life. And I think that feels really difficult. When I look back, I'm very lucky. The older I've got, the luckier I've felt in so many ways. But I'm lucky because I have lived through a period of incredible transformation. And I know that it is possible to drive change if you know what kind of change you want to drive. So it makes me less afraid about future casting, a different kind of community experience, a different kind of city experience. But many people don't have that lived.
Well, I was going to say, I think we are actually living in a time where everybody is, and you mentioned this before, about certainty and people, and I'll let you mention that again. But we're living in a time where I think actually we're so uncertain of what the future is that we're a bit paralyzed is the word I was looking for, compared to what I think that we've done in the past. Because if you were going to go and build something, it would take more than 5 years to implement that plan, and you know it's going to be okay. Whereas now we're not quite sure what that's going to look like. I mean, let's talk, if we're talking on a, you know, I live down on the Gold Coast. If I look at that, I kind of before moved here because I'm a crazy person, already looked at all the predictions of where, you know, where climate change was going to come in and what that was going to do. And I can say in the 3 years that I've been here, and obviously there's a lot of civil work going on to try and keep, you know, the beaches post-cyclone, we had some massive changes. But there's just so much going on in change. I've got friends who work in for Boeing and they work in the future, right? So they've been working with the government for the last 10 years talking about how we actually have cars that are going to be flying cars and what you're actually going to do. And I mean, you know, you sit in an Uber and it's going to drive you around somewhere. It's more probably what people and where we're at and legislation, what people are used to versus what is out there and how quickly that change could be as well.
So back in the Industrial Revolution, there's something called waves of change theory or destructive change theory. And from the Industrial Revolution to today, the first range of technological change took 60 to 75 years to mature and then decay. The next one took 50 years, the next one took 40 years. We're now working in 5 to 8 year cycles. So technologies that are being introduced today will be obsolete within 5 to 8 years. And these are the things that people, you know, really struggle with because they can't foresee what's going to happen next. There are things we do know, and anchoring ourselves in those things that we do know is helpful. So we do know, for example, that people are living longer, but they're not necessarily healthier. So the implication of that is we're going to have people, the largest growth sectors could be people aged 65, 75 and 85. What does that mean for how you design a city? We know we're getting hotter and that we need to be more mindful of what it will be like to be in less certain climatic conditions with more serious weather events. How do you design for that? Now we've got to design for an older population in a less stable climatic environment. And we're layering on top of that the fact that we don't trust each other as much as we used to. We don't trust where information comes from. We don't know who our friends and allies are going to be at any scale from 3 to 5 year period to another. So now there's a whole level of psychological uncertainty that we're layering across this dramatically changing population, dramatically changing climate. And then we start thinking about how technology weaves its way to all of those things. That's a very complex set of systems to try to understand together. And I think that's why we find it easier to make good strategic planning decisions than we do to set a strategic direction, because we can agree on what is good for everybody in the short term, but we can't necessarily agree on the right path to head for the long term.
Well, and there was a great thing you mentioned before about making a strategy versus a strategic plan and people agreeing.
I really wish that I had written this, but I did not write this. One of my colleagues reposted an article on LinkedIn, and it was effectively saying that strategic planning should be something that we all agree to because it's a good, well thought through technical plan. But setting a strategy should be something that around 50% of people disagree with, because it is making a decision about our future competitive advantage or our future place in the world or our future identity that everybody will not necessarily agree with. And that's quite a frightening thing for people who deal in politics or finance to contemplate, because you don't want 50% of people to think you made a bad decision.
But you won't be there for the next period.
Exactly. We start thinking in 3 and 5 year cycles because they're political and capital cycles. When a city is a century scale piece of infrastructure, so we should be making decisions for 20 years, 50 years and 100 years down the timeline.
I think there's two elements there. Now, you work internationally, okay, and I obviously, you know, have the privilege of meeting people and what I do and interviewing people from across the globe. It's funny in Australia because our history of built environment is what we're kind of going to get out. About 200 and something years old, right? Terrible, need some coffee today. But if you look across the globe, we're talking in millennia of years of, you know, if you meet somebody from Iran, they're talking in millennia of when like cities were made and where this history is. But the other thing is that if you're working in the Middle East or if you're working in Asia or if you're working in, you know, we live in a democratic country, right? So, and some of that has positives, which we all have fantastic rights and one of the best places in the world to live. But the hard thing is that it does mean that we have a much shorter viewpoint of looking at things versus working in countries where it is. And I'm really interested by obviously your background and where you've written. What impact do you see in how that actually makes people think? Because I meet people from the Middle East and they're like, or Egypt, and where literally I was like, did they just build that whole city in the desert? Just went, we're going to build this. This is going to happen.
It's one of the best parts of my job is that I get to work in, see, experience, explore other cities in completely different cultural and geographic and climatic conditions. And I have cities like other people, you know, have pop stars and movie stars that they admire. I definitely have city posters on my notional wall. So I look at places like Singapore. You know, Singapore was a swamp in 1956, and it's a leading first world nation today. And wow. Its plan and the vision of its founder and how Lee Kuan Yew set up its stages of development set the firmest of foundations. Ideologically, they've been translated, contemporized, but they've always remained the same, that land is a scarce resource for Singapore. People are a fundamental source of competitive advantage, that we have to make sure we use land wisely. We have strong decision-making around the urban form, about walkability, about public transit-led cities. We think really strategically about how we engage in the world. It is a very cleverly, strategically planned place at scale. And its journey is extraordinary. But the journey of Dubai is no less extraordinary. In 1985, there was nothing there. And it moved through a period as a global tourist destination to a city now which has got a, if not top 10, close to top 10 financial services positioning and is a city of impact. Riyadh, another extraordinary place to work and to witness the rebirth of a deep and proud kingdom in a contemporarily meaningful way, seeing social change and economic change and urban change happen there is actually a privilege. Or I could look closer to home and I could see how London made, you know, significant decision to abolish the Greater London Council and an equally significant decision 20 years later to reconstitute the Greater London Authority and to bring all of the functions of government for a city like London under a single umbrella. And I think what is common to all of these examples is that they have an organizational goal, a flag on a hill that they're walking towards, a uniform vision of the future, a plan that sets strong parameters about how to reach that future, but allows for flexibility in 5 and 10 year increments for life around you to change. So, it, you know, just as a small example of that, transport and sustainable transit, and that you can't dip in and out of this as a strategy. You either build your economic, your social and your environmental credentials around a sustainable transport network or you don't. And each of those cities has made that decision at a very different point in time and for different reasons.
Well, if we come back to now an Australian context in that, you know, we had a bit of a pre-chat. Obviously, I'm from Melbourne and then moved up here. And I must say the complete change in my life. Now, you live in Brisbane, you live in Tenerife. It's very similar to what my experience was. So, and I absolutely love where you live. It's my favourite part of Brisbane. But that is for the very reasons, as you mentioned, that you can walk to work, you can go everywhere, right? It's absolutely stunning. You can get everywhere. But that's not the same experience throughout the city. And as somebody who moved, I literally made the decision not to move to Brisbane because I stayed at a friend's house, I rode in, I was like, I nearly got killed. And as somebody who was like, I need to be able to ride to work every day. Unfortunately, I moved to Brisbane post 2020. So buying in Tenerife is not quite financially possible these days for somebody who's coming from Melbourne. It's very, very different. Whereas in Melbourne, I could live in a very large radius around the CBD and still have a very, very similar experience.
You're fundamentally quite correct. From a transport perspective, the systems and the networks are really different. For a start, Brisbane's transport network has been very bus oriented because of geography and geology. And we have built a centralized bus spine and we have managed our transit in a very different way, but we are still quite a car-borne location. Melbourne has a very strong tram network and it's inner city. It's got a good central city and middle ring opportunity, and projects like SRL help us to think about how new growth corridors actually are underpinned by sustainable transport. And that's the same when you look at places like Sydney. You know, Sydney has made a huge commitment to public transport since 2010. So its 2056 strategy, even the current projected high-speed rail Newcastle to Sydney, is all about changing the geography by changing movement patterns and changing proximity by changing time. So it's more difficult for Brisbane to achieve that, but I do feel that the metro and the Cross River Rail and the significant investment that's been made in walking and cycling infrastructure is starting to change it. So it's slow and it's harder to retrofit a city than it is to grow legacy infrastructure in the first place. But we need not only to provide infrastructure, we also have to change habits. And that's such a chicken and an egg story. So there are plenty of places where you can actually travel by bus or by CityCat or by other forms of sustainable transport, but people don't choose to. So carrot and stick, you've got to provide the transport infrastructure. You've got to make it hard or not enjoyable to use the car, or notionally punish people in other ways for taking their vehicle, road pricing, high parking, all of those sort of things. Changing habits is actually the more difficult aspect.
Well, I think we've probably got two things there that might, you know, there's different things that influence, right? Like definitely the 50 cents, I must say, has, like I go up and it'd be $20 and it's 50 cents. Like my mother, I said to her, she's in Sunshine Coast. It's like, let's meet, ride down. Yep, I'll meet you in Brisbane. 50 cents. It's like $1 it costs us each to meet each other.
That's definitely a game changer. I don't agree with anything being provided for free because people don't value it, but 50 cents is extraordinary value for money. And the service is excellent. And the more people use it, the more they become accustomed to use it and it actually becomes a default behavior. So I think that is very important. But the other element around that is also packaging the experience, if you like. So it's not just the point-to-point part. It's how do I move from my house to the bus stop or the train station, the first mile, and how do I move from the train station to my office, the shops, the cinema, wherever I'm going. So how do we make sure that not only that actual trip in the middle is working really well, but the walk to that is shaded, it's comfortable, it's clear, it's easy to cross the road. And then the same happens when you get to the other end, because 95% of the perception of your trip to work or your trip to the cinema is actually how you got to the bus stop or the train station and how you got from the train station to the place you were going. The bit in the middle is often the bit they forget.
Well, it's in some ways, I mean, I think if you're having to stand up all the way from the Gold Coast or, you know, and it is also the time and things, but we're talking about how we invest in cities and get a good return. I mean, and I'm waylaying here, but obviously I'm used to riding a bike everywhere and moved out. That was a part for me. And now where they've made changes and that was part of the transport. And it's a very good investment for cities, obviously getting people to ride a bike, especially when you're in Queensland and there's a lack of, you know, the weather's generally pretty good, right? So most days where I live, everybody just lives on an e-bike and we bought one and then we bought a second one because it's now, and we're not inherently lazy, aren't we, as human beings? We just really just want comfort, time, and if I can have my coffee or if I can do this or that, then that's what we go for. And I mean, I personally, that's as you said about habits, that's that habit once people start to do those things. And these days it makes it quite easy to do. Anyway, we're going very good. Just finishing on Southeast Queensland, obviously, you know, Southeast Queensland, most people think, you know, if they're in another state, it's Brisbane and the Gold Coast and Sunshine Coast. But for those who live in Queensland, we really do see this as it is one region, but it's a bit like Chile. Right, it kind of runs down the middle, and obviously there's a very distribution of how many kilometres you've got to run rail tracks or put roads in. But if you go either way, it's absolutely terrible to drive. So, you know, obviously with the Olympics and things like that coming up, what are some of the challenges and some of the opportunities that really sit for the Southeast Queensland?
I think Southeast Queensland is a fascinating city region that has all the potential to come into its own over the next decade and the decade that follows that. And how we think about ourselves as a cohesive region is really important. So we do have a regional plan and a regional infrastructure plan. But what I don't think we've established well as yet is a cohesive vision about the future of this region. We don't actually identify as a region. And so, you know, when people talk about, I went to the Dolomites or I went to Provence or I went to they name a place and you, or the Rockies, you immediately have a sense of what that place is about, what it stands for, what I'd find if I went there. when people say I went to Southeast Queensland, I don't think that connotes yet a story in their mind about its identity, its experience. And we're very emotional beings. We're driven by that desire to feel emotion, to be engaged by, to be able to explore and experiment. So we have incredible natural assets, diversity of landscape. We've got beautiful, they would call them mountains, I'd probably call them large hills. We've got coastal strips, we've got rivers, we've got bushland, which is exceptional. We've got cities we've got multiple cities that have very different characters, identities, stories, communities. We've got many regional towns and small settlements that provide us with this diversity of both urban and natural environments to explore, but we haven't really connected them up efficiently as yet. And you're quite right, the distances are vast and the density of settlement is relatively low. So in many ways, we've got to think quite carefully about how we create this networked region that actually does function better together. So just having a lot of people moving into a place and foreshadowing growth doesn't necessarily make it more productive, more livable, or more efficient in terms of its resource allocation. And we do need to think quite carefully about how we grow and where we put growth and how we channel the resources that we have in a much more responsible way. And that's going to mean big changes in how we design, plan, live, operate within Southeast Queensland if we want it to be a more sustainable place that we're leaving for our children than the one we inherited.
And so obviously we are talking about cities, but one of the things is that, you know, we also have levels of government and who is it being able to influence. So we've got lots of, and I mean, the LGAs are a lot smaller than you'll find in Melbourne in comparison. And then we've also got, you know, state governments that are very different where that funding is coming. Then we've got national, the federal government as well.
First of all, you should never tell your host they're not correct, but I don't think that's quite correct. Some of our local governments are actually pretty big.
They're massive in Queensland. In Melbourne, sorry, they're tiny. Coming to Queensland, you're like,
got some really big ones.
They're very, very large LGAs covering. But my point is that if you look at Southeast Queensland alone, even though they're very large LGAs, you've just got so many. But then I look at that transfer, and it's only because of my lived experience. I'm sorry, I don't have as much lived experience as you do in Devonshire, but I'm very, very interested by what impact that has, because at the end of the day, those decisions can't be made unless somebody is making those and making plans and committed to that as well.
You are quite right. And Queensland itself is really large, and Southeast Queensland is only one part of a much bigger entity. And there's often a lot of challenge around. We're putting a lot of effort and a lot of thinking into Southeast Queensland. What about the rest of the bits of Queensland? So that's the first level of tension, I think, that we have. The second is that vertical tension between federal, state, local government, and then this awkward thing in the middle, this kind of regional viewpoint that stitches together a number of, in our case, quite large local government areas into a notional entity. But if you look at the UK as a really good example, they had regional planning policy that actually set targets for London and the rest of the southeast against a whole load of parameters. And they have something called the Standing Conference for London and Southeast Region, I think it's called. It's not a great acronym, is it? But the idea was that transport, for example, economic development, housing targets would not just be set by a plan for that region, like we have the regional plans, but that there would actually be a standing conference, a standing committee to discuss the execution of this, to remove roadblocks, to provide that collaborative, semi-formal layer of collaboration that actually makes a regionalized perspective work. And I think that's quite an interesting model to think about. But are we really implying that we'd want a fourth level of administration to battle our way through? So the present government is very much about being more efficient, more streamlined in its planning processes, more intentional in, and some people might even say slightly more directive in terms of where investment goes. And that's probably a good thing, that whilst we naturally like everybody to win a prize, everybody cannot win a prize. And some places are always bound to be able to compete sooner or more forcefully, or in a different market than others. And so being really aware of where we're strong, where we have a right to win, where we are more likely to succeed early. I think those kind of conversations are very important and we shouldn't shy away from them.
And is that something you see here in Australia? How do you find that, Australia's viewpoint?
It's pretty tense, actually. I think it can be very tense that we have a tendency to compete when we need to cooperate. As a group of friends, I think we're quite competitive, and not just on the sports field, but in life in general. And sometimes we do need to look at the other side of that coin and think more about what cooperation, economic cooperation, social cooperation might look like. And there was a report that was done by Greg Clark and Tim Moonen and the Business of Cities a few years back, which really looked at the differences between some of the Scandinavian nations, which were at a similar scale, or some of the regions and cities within Canada, and how they actively cooperated as a model for how we might more actively cooperate across Australian regions.
And what are some of the things that they were doing?
Well, just a very basic example that stuck in my mind was in Canada, Calgary, Edmonton, and a couple of Vancouver, and I've forgotten the full city, were very clear what their economic strengths were. They were very clear how they would compete in terms of attracting large-scale events or inward investment or going out to look for economic or business-based investment into each of those cities so that they actually stopped cannibalizing each other's opportunities and started cooperating to succeed. And I think that was quite an interesting move that they made. And it's a little bit like some of the cities in the Ruhr and in Germany did a similar thing as they went through a process of industrial restructuring. They weren't all trying to do the same thing. And one of the discourses, you know, we hear a lot around not just Southeast Queensland or Brisbane, but actually a lot of Australian cities, even when it comes to things like innovation, everything cannot be an innovation precinct. Everything is not going to be an innovation precinct. Biomedicine is not going to succeed everywhere, but it becomes a byword and everybody wants to be one and wants to have one. And we find it very difficult to actually say our best chance of winning is here and this is why. And we're going to put all our eggs into this basket. And sometimes I think we forget we're a small nation with a big heart in a massive country. And so we have to be much more mindful and intentional about how we curate competitive advantage.
And I think that is one of the things. I mean, obviously, you know, you hear these livable cities or you hear these places where people want to work, live in certain places and why they want to do what they do. And I think that's one of the challenges is that you're right. People come up here, right, for the beautiful weather. But there's a lot of things where it's not that accessible. And now that things are getting quite expensive, a lot of people won't be able to live in those ideal areas.
But at the same time, we also don't accept the change that might enable that to happen. So we don't want density, height, density, building mass. That sounds like a terrible thing. I like what I've got. I like the quarter acre block. And everybody is not going to live in a quarter acre block in the future. And that is not an Australian dream we can perpetuate. For some people in some places, it will remain a choice. For others, it will not. So understanding what a new Australian dream might look like that does allow us to accommodate sustained population growth and change. People who are living 85, 90, wanting to walk in a community that's around a house, not living in a retirement resort in a middle ring suburb, we need to think differently about what that's going to look like.
Oh, it's very exciting. All right. Now, I know one of the things that you've been also, you're going to be talking at the Urban Developer and you've been doing some speeches on AI. Obviously, this world is coming and it's going to change. We're going to talk about skills because I think you've got some fantastic things to talk about that and what do you tell your future self. But let's talk about the impact of AI, both on the profession and the industry. But I'm also interested on, from your perspective, of what this might look like for cities.
Look, honestly, I was terrified about AI. I actually did not even really understand what AI was. And the whole reason I did the presentation for the Urban Developer last year was to challenge myself, to force myself into a corner to find out about it. And when Adam approached me, he said, how would I feel about doing this? I said, I'll tell you what, let's do a live presentation. And then I went back to the office and said to my team, hey, I want to do a live presentation of how AI can work in a master planning scenario. And they all went, are you mad? That will never work. You do not have the capability to do that. You've overreached yourself. And I thought, I'll show you. And the thing I found most interesting is AI is not new. We had the idea around AI 2,400 years ago. And all it really means is getting something inanimate, which could be a robot or a computer or anything you liked, to do a job a human would ordinarily have to do. And I think, again, because humans like certainty and predictability and are averse to change, the idea that we are relinquishing some of these tasks to an inanimate object feels terrifying. And the thing that we forget is, number one, AI doesn't make dumb people smart. You need smart people to use AI smartly. The second thing, so we should be less fearful and actually more willing to invest in understanding how to use these tools to our advantage. And then the second thing is, once I started, it really wasn't as frightening as I thought it was going to be. It was actually quite liberating. And I could completely see, and all I was using, just, you know, full disclosure, I used tools that people can readily use. So Perplexity, I used Claude, it was just coming in at the time, and I used the professional ChatGPT. Nothing very scary. And I'm an old middle-aged housewife who really is not very good with technology. If I can do it, anyone can do it. And what I did was I disaggregated master planning processes and I tested these platforms to see whether at every one of 8 stages that you'd conventionally go through to master plan a large scale development, a decent scale development, how could it help me? And I discovered that it could analyze, it could draw and analyze information better than I could. It could allow me to run so many different scenarios and queries before breakfast that would have taken a team of graduates a month to do. And if I trained it well, if I invested in it, and if I treated it meanly by saying, no, you guessed that, only use authority sources, only use the ABS, only do this, it increasingly became quite reliable. However, what that showed me was also that if you didn't understand your job and you didn't actually have a sense of what was right and what wasn't right, you wouldn't necessarily spot the problems in the data sets. So the pattern recognition is built on your own expertise, really. Where I discovered that it could model things beautifully, so I could say, here's 3 scenarios, which one will give me the smallest ecological footprint? Which one is going to use the most greenhouse gas in its construction and operation? Which one is going to accommodate the most people with the least deleterious effect on land? Just which one will give me the best view corridors? Which one is the most livable? I could constrain those parameters in any way I wanted, and it would create me a well-reasoned answer. It could visualize things in real time. It could predict what the planning department would say by scanning all its policy documents and saying, your argument falls short here, you should have thought about this. It could look for global precedents in a way that I could only dream of. It could do all these things that made me more efficient and more powerful in terms of driving decisions. So I loved that. Then I got to the bit where I started asking it, what's the vision? What's the story? And it couldn't do it because it's not sentient and it doesn't have emotion. However well I trained it, however much I gave it my voice, it couldn't relativize to that place and that part of the world something that would be so intrinsic and unique. It just couldn't do it. Everything it gave me was generic or applicable to multiple places. So that ability to be really, really place-based, really specific, really of the moment is still a stretch away.
I think the really interesting thing is that I think everybody's, you know, it's going to make massive differences. You know, they're talking about, I watched a video this morning about how it might potentially create entire professions gone. Right. But what was also
professions.
That's right. But what was really interesting in that, we were talking about skills and agents and looking at that. It was like, think of it like you're teaching a person. You're not going to have Jerry come in day one and go, oh, Jerry, go do this. It's like, show Jerry how to go through all the steps, teach it. It's innately going to remember that and draw upon context. And I think what's really interesting is those who are really playing with it, you can customize too. It's kind of like 10 times in yourself or 100 times in yourself.
Absolutely.
The only thing is, over time, it is going to build in. Mine is so into me. It knows everything of my history and who I am and how I talk and do that. And it's brilliant.
But the other thing it can also do is be everything you're not. So you can say to it, I want you to have a voice that is not my voice. I want you to be oppositional. I want you to be a 19-year-old man when you think about this. Or I want you to be someone who comes from a completely different, an African environmentalist. And I want you to actually speak with that voice to see how it challenges your perception. So you can ask it to be a provocateur. And in many ways, it's a bit like being MI5. You know, MI5 has lots of agents and you would pick the right agent for the job. You wouldn't pick 007 if you didn't have a license to kill. Like you'd pick a different agent. And it's exactly the same, that that you can assemble your bench strength of agents. And if you understand them, you can pick the ones best for the job and you can have my agent speak to your agent. We wouldn't even have to be there to do the boring stuff. All that sound check rubbish, that would have been done between my bot and your bot. And they were the things that I'd never appreciated. And as soon as I wrapped my head around the fact that AI had actually been around for 2,400 years, that Homer wrote about it so long ago, that the algorithms were actually created in the 1740s for predictive texts like ChatGPT. In the 1740s, that these are not new things. We're using them in new ways because our ability to actualize the technology has developed, but our ability to conceptualize what to do with it has always been there. Interestingly, now we can make the technology happen so fast that our imagination can't catch up with how we might want to use it. So we've almost inverted the problem that we started with. So I got to the end and I went, you know what? I will still have a job because my job is to know what to ask and to know whether what they've given me back is right and to assemble all these pieces of information in the same way that I would assemble a team of experts and take their advice to turn it into something. That these jobs still exist, they're just different jobs. And that is no different to what happened when the Industrial Revolution came along.
How do you think this is going to look for those coming out and graduating now?
I think it's so exciting. I wish I could live my whole life again because the adventure ahead of you will be different to the adventure I have, but it's no less powerful. And the ability to work in cyber-physical teams, to use data to allow the environment to understand itself and to give us real-time feedback is incredibly exciting. And that technology empowers us. It shouldn't frighten us. It should make us feel encouraged about a future in which we can make better decisions, model scenarios faster, make no regrets decisions. So I think that is really exciting. The thing that concerns me is that we actually have great education and training pathways for urban professionals here. We really do. We export planners around the world. We have incredible urban designers and landscape designers. We build on our understanding of country that our First Nations provide us with. We have engineers who are better than engineers in almost any country. You find them everywhere you go. But we actually need people with imagination now and storytelling qualities and empathy and people who are boundary spanners, happy to be interdisciplinary and interdisciplinary by themselves almost, who can take elements of this and elements of that and understand that application in a synthesized way. And they're not necessarily how we have taught professionals over the last 25 years. So when I look for somebody to join my team, I'm looking for somebody who is curious, somebody who has no ego, doesn't think they have all the answers, doesn't think they will ever have all the answers, that's the excitement, who understands that we are creating cities, precincts, places, housing products for people. And therefore, everything we do should be to the betterment of people. And that where we have a thriving community, we'll have a thriving economy. It's a different way of thinking about it. And I think that's the challenge we have now. It's not about technical capability as much as it's about imagination and understanding the qualitative as much as the quantitative.
Well, and I think that's going to be the interesting part for the next sort of journey for the evolution. Like I look at my kids and I think, what's education going to look like for you, right? How's this going to actually equate? And then I think, how do you now think to learn and apply in a different way? Because, you know, I grew up, I'm 41, so, you know, slightly different. You had another few years on me, but I remember when we had CBD-ROMs and Botanica, right? Whereas the next 10 years after me is always had the internet. Why would you have, like, you just Google it. And now it's like you don't even Google. You just talk to your phone and it'll find the answers for you. And now this is what is potentially changing in the education system and how we actually teach children and people to be questioning and doing that and what they still need to learn and the principles. I think it's going to be hard for graduates, though, if they're not getting that.
Totally. Like critical and creative thinking are hard to teach. They're quite intrinsic. And I was actually reflecting on this the other day that if I'm lazy, I don't ask Claude or ChatGPT the right question. I ask them the easy question. And then I get back an answer that I'm not satisfied by. And I know it's not the right answer, but if I was less discriminating and lazy, I would ask the obvious question and I get an answer that wasn't necessarily the right answer. So this ability to actually say, what am I really trying to interrogate? What do I really want to know? How do I ask that question, not once, but multiple times, so I can cross-refer? If I can get an answer in 8 seconds, I can ask that question 10 ways. And then I can really start to close in on what does the terrain actually look like. But if you're not inspired to be curious, you wouldn't bother.
It's quite funny. My son is 5 and he is going through a phase. I know that. And it's like, you need to understand, you should never be a know-it-all. You should never know. Yes. You should always be curious. Always be asking, I don't know. It's like, oh, but I know what Melbourne is. Something. I'm like, but you don't know this. You don't know that. Yes. And it will be very, very interesting how, as you said, some of it's innate, but it's also your mind is. I'm obviously a very naturally curious person. That's how I end up doing what I'm doing. And I love understanding everything, right? Sometimes too much, as my partner says. Probably don't need this much to understand that. But I think that is the future, because you can literally sit there and you could learn a university degree, as you said, by asking questions.
It's fantastic. There isn't a single day that I get up where I don't think I'm going to learn 5 or 6 brand new things today. And in fact, I recently did a PhD. I was 54 when I enrolled in it, and I was 58 when I got it. And I had a full-time job all the way through, and I loved every minute of it. There wasn't a single moment of doing it where I didn't feel like I was alight with happiness, that it was my happy flow state, because every time I sat at my desk, I learned something new. And everything I learned made me want to ask another question. So, you know, I think that thirst to understand is a really important driver for getting to a point where we demand a better future.
Mm.
And one of the questions you asked that caused me the most angst was, what is the advice, if I was looking back and I was giving myself different advice for the future, you know, what are the things I would tell myself that I've learned the hard way over 35 years? And I think the first thing was that you actually don't have to be right all the time. In fact, you don't have to be right at all. I think I spent a lot of the first decade of my professional career wanting to prove I was right. And I was worthy because I had knowledge and I was right. And you should come to me because I will be right. In fact, you should come to me because I believe I'm not always right, but I will work really hard to see what the right answer is and to interrogate it in a million ways. So you don't always have to be right. And actually the most profound learning comes when you're wrong. That was something I definitely would tell myself. I think I also spent a lot of time walking around with my eyes down where I should have had my eyes up. And I was always thinking about this problem, not about what else could be or how else I could see the world around me. So I definitely encourage myself to look out before I looked in. And I think that was a really important thing for me to learn. I was very introspective when I was young, but the sense of discovery has served me much better. And I think being generous is something I wish I'd learned earlier, that we tend to think that ideas are knowledge of power, and it makes you more desirable as a consultant and a colleague because you know things. Actually sharing things is what makes you more attractive as a colleague and as a consultant. So that generosity and the idea, once it's born, is your idea. You can do whatever you like with it. That is what it means to me to be an opinion former or a leader, is to share your ideas willingly, be prepared to have an idea and give it away and have another one tomorrow. And then the last thing I really wish I'd told myself is that your career is a marathon, not a sprint, but you run hard at it every day, that it is something you have to invest in. And you have to put a lot of effort into a career that you will enjoy. And otherwise you're going to wake up and 30 years will have passed and you won't have done the things you had hoped to do or reached the potential you had. So, you know, be generous, be wrong, be open to the things around you and run a really hard race are the 4 things I would have told myself.
Well, and I think the fantastic thing is, professionals in this industry, you've got the ability to work in so many different ways, and you've got the ability to work all across the world and to learn things and have different experiences and work with different people. You know, you need to have some stability and grow within that, but there's so much diversity within and so many things you can do. And I think and the other great thing is you actually get to see things built or see those changes. Maybe in your area it's a bit more over decades than it is, but actually see things come from an idea to now actually being implemented, and the impact that that has on people is fantastic.
It's hugely exciting.
Brilliant, Kate. Thank you so much for joining us today. It has been an absolute pleasure. I could listen to you all day. It's been fantastic. Now, Kate, we always ask people if there's a podcast, a book or something like that that you would sort of TED Talk, anything that you would reference to people to check out.
Oh, my God. Well, I have a whole list. I could have just given you like a massive list.
We'll put it in the show notes. So what we do is you're going to send us, we'll send it to you.
If there was one thing I would suggest people looked at, is maybe a little bit non-conforming, but because cities are about cognitive experience and emotion, I would direct them towards Ingrid Setter Lee's book, Joy or Joyful, I think it's called actually. And she has a podcast too. And it's about the importance of feeling joy in the everyday and how joy lights you up and it allows you to be open to new experiences, new things, to be more creative, more receptive. It profoundly changed my life listening to her and reading her book. So it would probably be that.
Brilliant. Absolutely. Well, we'll definitely include that. And if there's any others that you have, we can pop them in the show notes. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Have a lovely afternoon.
That was an absolute pleasure. I absolutely love talking to Kate, and there is so many amazing things. There's not many podcasts I don't really say too much in, but I could just keep listening to her for hours, and we probably could do about 7 more podcasts on the fantastic things that she has. I hope you enjoyed it, and if you are looking to have a fantastic keynote speaker, I would highly recommend that you reach out to Kate. She'll be able to come up for any topic and give you a great conversation.